Hello. From the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, this is the Tech Policy Grind podcast. Here our fellows chat with leaders in the internet law and policy space on recent developments and exciting topics. AI, privacy, internet governance, cybersecurity, tech legislation, and so much more. I'm your host, Justice Shannon. I'm a member of the sixth cohort of the Foundry Fellowship. The Foundry is a collaborative organization of internet law and privacy professionals who are passionate about disruptive innovation. Today, I'm speaking with Professor Eric Goldman. He is an expert on First Amendment law and internet policy. Today, we are speaking on FSC v. Paxton. Professor Goldman, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi. As you mentioned, my name is Eric Goldman, and I am a law professor at Santa Clara University School of Law. I hold some other hats there as well. I am Associate Dean for Research. I'm co-director of the High Tech Law Institute, and I'm co-supervisor of the Privacy Law Certificate. I've been doing internet law for 30 years, and I have been tracing the issues we're going to discuss since their origin back in 1996, when I had already been practicing law. So it's a great honor to be here today with this conversation, especially because I love the work of the Foundry, and I'm honored to be a part of the conversation.
We're grateful to have you. So we're going to start with, you mentioned you started your legal career in the mid-90s. Let's take a step back just before that. We're going to do five questions on how you got to law and how you got into the internet law industry. So to start, what career opportunities were you most interested in K through 12 before you knew law was an option, or was law the option for you?
I had always saw myself as a business person, maybe an entrepreneur. I think that was the most common set of career destinations that I had. I certainly was interested in rules and rules of law, as I think many of my peers were. But I don't know that I really had a good vision about what that would look like. Of course, back in the day, you know, the TV depictions were always police procedural type stuff. So, you know, the kind of law careers I saw depicted in the media didn't really speak to me. I don't know that those were my strengths, but certainly the idea of understanding how the economic system works and what I could do to be a part of it was always on my mind.
Fair. Thank you. So at what point did law become the consideration, a consideration?
I thought about taking the LSAT when I was in my last year of college, but my heart wasn't in it at the time. It wasn't really where I saw myself at the time. And I ended up going and working in commercial real estate after graduation. And when I thought about going back to grad school, for me, I actually envisioned myself becoming a real estate developer. That was my target. So I enrolled in a JD MBA program at UCLA with the hope that I would build both the business side of the real estate piece, but also the legal side that any developer has to navigate in order to complete their project. So my target all along going into grad school was real estate development. And the law part was actually coming along for the ride. The MBA was really the centerpiece of that.
And how many years did you work between your undergrad and JD?
I worked 2 years in commercial real estate in Los Angeles. So graduating in 88, started law school in 90.
And can you speak to that gap, those gap years? Do you see that most of your peers took a gap, or was that unorthodox at the time?
Certainly in the legal field, most people were K through JD. In other words, they never took a break between their studies from college to law school. So in that sense, I had deviated from the plan. My mom certainly wasn't happy about that. She feared when I went to work in commercial real estate that I would never go back to grad school. And she always had her vision for me that I would need that additional training to achieve my professional goals. So she certainly didn't think that was a good move on my part and discouraged me. I think that was fairly common of the boomer style parents. My mom was actually a late stage silent generation, but it's pretty much the same. And how they were trying to counsel the Gen Xer kids, don't get off the academic path. Once you do, it's really hard to get back on. And if you get off that path, you're going to end up in a worse off outcome. I will note that because the MBA was the centerpiece of my graduate school target, MBA programs required people to have work experience before they were admittable. And having only 2 years of work experience was actually light for my MBA applications. They didn't view that as favorably. Many of the people in my MBA program had many years of experience. I only had two. I was at the very lowest end of experience coming into that program.
Would you say today that the students that you see come through into your classes have more work experience, or do you still see a lot of straight through KJD students? And what would at from a professor from a professorial direction do you prefer? Do you which would you recommend?
I don't have the exact stats at Santa Clara. My impression is roughly 50-50 between the people who are coming straight out of undergrad and the people who've had some sort of work experience. We have some people who just have a little bit of work experience, and then we have people who have decades of work experience in our community. And I will note that the pandemic has scrambled that a little bit. There were a number of students who had to get a job before they could go to law school, others who couldn't get a job and were eager to go to law school. The pandemic really put everyone's schedule into a blender. So things have gotten a little weirder in the last couple of years. To me, I'm agnostic about where people, what backgrounds people have. If they have work experience, that's great. And I often learn a bunch from them about that. But I learn a lot from my students who don't have that either, maybe in different ways. It's all good to me. And as an educator, my goal is to meet the students where they are and take them further along their path, wherever that is, however far along they already are. The thing I do benefit from in my class is when, even if, whether the students are had work experience before law school or not, I benefit when the students are actually working in the field while they're taking the class, or if they've had some experience before taking the class, like in the summer position before they start my class. The students often ask sharper questions about the things they've seen in the field. So it's really great when I have that kind of experience. But that's not about pre-law school experience. It's the stuff they've experienced in law school.
You didn't hear it because I was muted, but I was snapping my fingers. That was a phenomenal answer.
Or a plus one there in the nonverbal sense.
Absolutely. All right, last question before we hop into case law, as poetically as possible. Why internet law? For you, why internet law?
So I mentioned that my goal going to grad school was to become a real estate developer, and somehow I ended up in internet law, which I don't say is like a polar opposite, but it's definitely not a natural or preferred path. But when I got my first email account in 1991, it just blew my mind. It was clear that this was something powerful and different than the other ways that we were talking to each other at the time. And I got really excited about the potential of that. And then I did a bunch of other things in 1992. I did things like join bulletin board services, which I had to dial up and log into. I started subscribing to Usenet. I was on email lists. And the internet was taking over a big chunk of my life back then. And I decided to write my law school paper on it and on some legal topic related to the internet. And in so doing, I realized it just was my passion. This is something that I cared about so much more than a real estate development or any of the other alternatives I had been considering at the time. This is something I was deeply passionate about. And of course, it was a very exciting time. There were no people, not many people who claimed to be internet lawyers at the time because it was so new and there wasn't a lot of commercial activity there. So it was a wide open field for me on something that I was already deeply shaping my life, that had blown my mind, given me epiphany, and that I just realized I was deeply passionate about.
Phenomenal. Thank you. I want to say that that's a perfect transition into internet law questions, but prior to, I think we have a small conversation on constitutional law to have. So, first, can you explain rational basis, intermediate scrutiny, and strict scrutiny to our listeners who may not have the context?
Right, so let's go back to the very basic paradigm that there are three branches of power in our government as designed by our Constitution. And the executive branch acts as the operating function. The legislative branch is one that sets the rules and also sets the budget. And then our court system evaluates the acts of the executive branch and legislative branch to ensure that they are following their own rules and following the meta rules that are baked into our Constitution. The idea behind the Constitution is that our country has set some rules that are not supposed to be easily amended by the executive branch or legislative branch, that it's hard to change these rules. These are the core set of principles that we want to make sure that our country always follows. And so it is quite common for the legislative branch and the executive branch to do things that raise potential conflicts with the Constitution. And our court system is a way of figuring out if, in fact, those conflicts exist. And the Supreme Court over the years has developed a methodology for doing that constitutional review, taking a look at the actions of the executive branch or legislative branch and deciding if it's constitutional. Essentially, they've established three levels of scrutiny. It's a little more complicated, but it's good enough to start there. There's strict scrutiny, which is the highest level of scrutiny that the government will face. And in the process of doing so, the practical consequence of a law facing strict scrutiny is that the law is likely to be declared unconstitutional. That's in contraposition to rational basis scrutiny, where the basically just looks to see whether or not there's some logic, even if it's the dumbest logic, behind the government's actions. In other words, it's so deferential, almost every law survives rational basis scrutiny. And then there's this third level of scrutiny that's developed over the years called intermediate scrutiny, which is essentially supposed to be like a coin flip. Instead of the presumption of invalidity with strict scrutiny or the presumption of validity with rational basis, there's this intermediate zone where it's a food fight. And because of the fact that the level of scrutiny is essentially outcome determinative when the court decides that strict or scrutiny or rational basis scrutiny applies, the process of deciding which level of scrutiny applies is actually where much of the battle really takes place.
Thank you. Transitioning, you mentioned that you found that this opinion is Cavanball. Can you define what Cavanball is for the audience?
So it's impossible for me to talk about many of the things I'm observing in internet law, but frankly, across our entire country, without using the term Calvinball. And Calvinball is a reference to the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes, which is a beloved comic strip from the 80s and 90s. And it involved two characters, a rambunctious young kid and his imaginary friend, a stuffed tiger that would come to life in his mind. And the kid and the tiger would play a game that the kid called Calvinball, after himself, of course. And there was only one rule of Calvinball, which is that they could never invoke the same rule twice. So they play these games that at each stage along the game, they're now negotiating over the rules because they can't do any precedent in their games. The rules have to be created each time afresh. And Calvinball is really the opposite of the rule of law. The whole point of Calvinball is not to follow precedent. It's not to apply the same rule multiple times. And the rule of law is all about establishing clear rules and then applying them consistently in a predictable manner so that everyone can know what the rules are and can follow them if they choose to. So Calvinball is really, it's a derogatory term in this context. It's really a way of saying we are throwing the rule of law into the blender and doing something else. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing so often. And we're going to definitely discuss that in the case of Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. So many of the questions that you're about to answer me are answerable only if we admit, as painful as it is, the Supreme Court was choosing to play Calvinball, not applying the rule of law.
So that almost answers the next question then. Was this the opinion you were expecting? If not, what were you expecting?
So this was not the opinion I was expecting, but let me clarify why. There are two levels at which I was not expecting this opinion. The first level is that from the oral arguments, it was clear that there was not enough votes to uphold the Fifth Circuit's determination that the law in question should be subject to rational basis scrutiny. It was clear to me that the court could not accept that. And that was true across all the political spectrum on the court. So the logical conclusion from that is that they were going to do something that was going to reverse the Fifth Circuit. And instead, they upheld the Fifth Circuit, reaching the same conclusion through a different path. And that was unexpected for at least for me. The second thing is that they reached an outcome that I could have never imagined, which we're going to talk about later on, about the fact that the court concluded that the law should be subject to intermediate scrutiny. That is just the wackiest thing. But the more important piece is then the Supreme Court then didn't send it back down to lower courts to apply intermediate scrutiny in the first instance. They did it all themselves. They did all that work de novo. And I would never have guessed that they would have done that. That to me was absolutely not in the wheelhouse of potential outcomes. So in that sense, I was really surprised. The fact that they upheld the opinion wasn't as surprising only because we knew that everything that the Supreme Court was doing at this point was putting past precedent into a blender. And it wouldn't be surprising they put past precedent from the Supreme Court into a blender again. So that part wasn't surprising. But how they did it was surprising, and it really was quite unsettling.
Can you explain why Justice Thomas steps away from the strict scrutiny standard in this opinion, or why you believe he steps away from the strict scrutiny opinion standard?
You know, I've read the opinion multiple times trying to answer that very question. And I ultimately think this is the first of several examples I'm going to give where the opinion is just Calvin ball, that Justice Thomas knew what result he wanted to get. He then just deployed a series of rhetorical tricks and analytical tools to reach that result that I cannot easily answer. There are precedents on the side of saying that the governing scrutiny should have been rational basis. That's what the Fifth Circuit held. There's precedent saying that that strict scrutiny should apply. That was what the district court held, as well as the obvious implications of the Reno versus ACLU and Ashcroft versus ACLU opinions. And Justice Thomas just plays around with those doctrines multiple times to reach just an inexplicable result. So I'm going to give a few examples of how he plays around with that and why then that takes him towards intermediate scrutiny, but it's not a credible reason. I'm not explaining it in ways I think are convincing. I'm just trying to find how he's playing his game. So he says a few things. He says that there's this category of things called obscene as to minors content that is only partially protected by the First Amendment, which is weird. And then he says that if it's only partially protected, I'm sorry, he doesn't say this, but the way I would read that is if it's only partially protected, that means that rational basis scrutiny should apply. The Fifth Circuit got it right. The state wins because of the fact that they're going to get the gentle scrutiny. And so everything else beyond that is trying to push the scrutiny level above rational basis, but keep it below strict scrutiny. So he says things like there's offline age authentication, and offline age authentication is so ubiquitous and so venerable that if we were to do anything that would cast a doubt on that, strict scrutiny is too strong. That makes no sense. He says that the precedent, the ACLU versus Reno case and Ashcroft case, can be distinguished because in those cases, the age authentication option was a defense, not an element of the plaintiff's prosecution, whereas an HB 1118 is an element of the plaintiff's prosecution. And that means that the old cases involved a ban on speech, where these applied to only restrictions on speech. And somehow that then turns into, we shouldn't apply strict scrutiny because it's not a ban, it's a restriction. Not credible. Bans and restrictions of speech are treated the same for purposes of what scrutiny level applies. You make the difference on how you apply that scrutiny between bans and restrictions. And so, like, it's just Calvin ball. Like, each time he's doing things that are designed to throw tradition into and precedent into the trash and find a way to justify somehow this idea that intermediate scrutiny is the appropriate one. I could not teach this to my class in a way that I would feel comfortable that they would understand what to do in the next phase.
So I guess, so that feeds into my next question, which is the majority opinion and the dissent seem to disagree with each other about past precedent, what past precedent to cite here. Do you have any idea where that disagreement comes from? And what would you cite as appropriate past precedent for this case?
So there's a few ways to get at this. The court could have made a distinction between online and offline age authentication for reasons I explained in my paper, and I can't recall if we're going to get to that later or not. But the court equates the two and says that they need to be treated the same. But there's so many reasons why they should be treated differently. They are functionally different. And if you do that, then it becomes clear that the offline precedent cases are not the right ones. Only the online ones should be. And then, as I mentioned, the fact that Justice Thomas says that there's a difference between the bans at issue in the prior opinions and restrictions in this case is neither factually persuasive, nor is that the way that constitutional analysis has gone in the past. So it seems obvious to me that the past precedent should apply. This ban versus restriction stuff is just window dressing around the underlying issues. And part of the problem for Justice Thomas is he voted in the majority in both the ACLU versus Reno case and the Ashcroft versus the ACLU case. In both cases, he sided in favor of striking down the laws. So if he wants to have any intellectual consistency, he's got to justify why he is ignoring the precedent that he had voted in. And if the best he can come up with is the difference between bans and restrictions, then he's pretty deep into Calvin ball.
Phenomenal. So it sounds like you're saying that the split on precedent here is a distinction between online precedent and offline precedent. And for the online precedent, you've cited to Ashcroft and Reno. Can you cite to the cases that Tom is cited to for the offline precedent real quick?
Yeah, the main one was the Ginsburg case, which involved the offline retailer sale of pornography to minors. That included a defense that the retailer had a reasonable process for authenticating the age of their offline buyers. And the court applied rational basis scrutiny in that circumstance.
And in the opinion, Justice Thomas cites to states that if we were to apply strict scrutiny here, we would find age verification online unconstitutional. It would also apply in situations like liquor stores and cigarette purchases. Correct.
So yes, he was saying that somehow or another that if the court were to apply strict scrutiny to online age for authentication, that would cast too much doubt on offline age authentication, not just for speech-related items that are being sold, like, say, books or magazines or movies, but for all other forms of services or goods in the marketplace that are subject to age authentication in the offline world, like cigarettes or fireworks. And that is an argument. It's not a persuasive argument at all. It is obvious that treating speech the same as cigarettes is misguided because there are no speech implications with the restriction of the sale of cigarettes. But there are a lot of speech implications with respect to the restriction of access to constitutionally protected material. So, this is just another form of the Calvin ball that by trying to equate items that have no relationship to each other in any meaningful way and saying that we had to treat them all the same, he was able to bootstrap himself up from the restrictions in the offline world and say that that should validate the restrictions in the online world. I will note that a restriction on the sale of fireworks or lottery tickets or cigarettes from a First Amendment standpoint would get rational basis scrutiny. There's no speech implications there in the first place. So again, if he's going to equate the two, he's back at rational basis.
Thank you for the clarification. guess that the question then is, the dissent points out that age verification online presents a number of concerns along data privacy, along the potential for phishing attacks that you don't normally, that you wouldn't see online. How does the majority opinion address these concerns? And do you find these attempts valid?
So in a sense, basically, the majority sidesteps that question by doing the intermediate scrutiny level themselves and not sending it back down to lower court. They didn't open up the door for further discovery on that issue, for further argumentation on that issue, for the parties to tell their best story about why there might be differences between the online and offline age authentication requirements for purposes of intermediate scrutiny. Remember, they have been arguing at rational basis and strict scrutiny in the lower courts. So this was a new application that the court, the majority did itself without opening up the door for further argumentation to be more precise on that front. And in general, I think when we're talking about the online age authentication problems, the majority sidestepped all of the questions about this with just the most bizarre line, where the court says that all adults do not have the constitutionally protected right to receive content free from age authentication. And from my perspective, that then just blows apart all the problems. By saying that there's not this constitutional protection, the court ignores the perspectives of the publishers and what rights they have. And by framing in the needs of the receiver, the court basically doesn't account for all the problems that they experience in this problem. The court just says they have no interest here. So we can ignore all the problems that are being created for them.
So you provided a piece of the quote from a paragraph just now. Adults have no First Amendment rights to avoid age verification. Paragraph goes on to say, and any burden experienced by adults is therefore only incidental to the statute's regulation of activity that is not protected by the First Amendment. What does this statement say towards data privacy or online anonymity rights that adults or users online may be concerned with?
Just let's go back to the TikTok decision earlier this year, a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court upholding the TikTok ban. That was TikTok versus Garland, where, among other things, the court pointed to the concerns about adults' privacy concerns in justifying why censorship should be imposed. And so, like, the court's just playing around with privacy. Sometimes it matters to adults, sometimes it doesn't. Like, it's just whatever their mood is du jour. So I really think that the court's or the majority's effort to basically say, we're going to stop talking about publishers' interests, we're going to turn it around on the receivers, and we're going to say the receivers have no constitutional protection here, without explaining why that's the case, just making the flat, unsupported assertion allows it to say, if it doesn't want to engage with adults' privacy concerns, it doesn't have to. It can just ignore them.
And so who does that put the onus to protect user data on at that point?
I don't think that that's something this opinion addresses. We know that the statute requires authenticators to take certain steps that would improve the security of the data that they are exposed to. The opinion may or may not actually have turned on that point. If the state hadn't required that, I think the decision would be the same. So really, I think the court just doesn't care.
Well, how does the majority address the possibility that some adults may not be able to navigate age verification gates?
simply doesn't consider that whatsoever because of the fact that they've taken this position that there's this constitutional free zone when it comes to adults trying to overcome age authentication barriers. They don't care about any of the consequences that follow from that. Their answer would simply be, if anyone gets lost in the system, lost in the shuffle, that sucks for them, but they have no constitutional standing to complain about it. This is a good example where if the majority had remanded the case to lower courts, the lower courts would have heard evidence about this. There would have been more data about the fact that there are millions of Texas adults who will be blocked by this law from accessing content that the majority says is constitutionally protected content as for them. And because that evidence is not in play here, the majority can simply erase those harmed individuals from the equation and ignore their constitutional violations they experience. So it's such a damning statement on the court when it says we don't have to consider who's going to get screened out, why they're going to get screened out, if they can even overcome it. None of that is germane to the majority's assessment.
So this is the second time now that you've said because the court did not remand to the lower court to make these reviews, we don't have the answer to these questions. So this presents the question of why did the court decide not only the level of scrutiny, but also the outcome, and what should we do with that? Like, where do we go from there?
So I will point out the difference between how the court handled the Moody case a year ago, where the court remanded the case back down to the lower courts to sort through their opinion. And the majority opinion gave a bunch of guidance to the lower courts, but didn't actually reach the conclusion that strict scrutiny had to apply or that the laws were going to fail. Those were opened up for the lower courts to do that work in the first instance.
How do you respond to people who say, okay, well, maybe it's there's a point where we say it's about time for that. We have platforms where there's content for kids in close proximity to what this court would define as obscene content, which is potentially why states like Texas have said if your platform is 30% or more obscene content, you have to provide age verification.
So the threshold number is just so interesting because that is the major innovation, in my opinion, from the earlier CDA and COPPA laws didn't have any kind of numerical threshold. They basically said if you have a single incident of content that's regulated by the statute, then you must engage in age authentication. And so the approach that Texas and other states have adopted is to create this one-third threshold and say this means that most websites or apps are not going to be regulated because of the fact that they come nowhere close to meeting that threshold. And the Supreme Court doesn't really engage with that number. They acknowledge it and don't really care. But it actually matters quite a bit because any adult website, website that is primarily in the business of adult content could easily just add non-adult themed content and drop below that one-third threshold. This kind of thing that then suggests that the means fit analysis is actually really poor, that the law doesn't do a very good job of advancing its goal if it's so easy that all a website has to do to avoid complying with the law is go out to generative AI, generate a trillion pieces of data that are not adult themed, add that to their database, and now they're no longer regulated by the law. Like, that's just stupid and socially counterproductive. And the means fit analysis ought to take advantage of that. The court didn't give space for that kind of an argument because they did the intermediate scrutiny analysis without allowing for that argument to be advanced. So otherwise, then, you know, if we ignore the one-third standard, and we're going to try and establish a universe where we're going to distinguish between adult content websites and others, which has always been a fraught issue. But let's assume that we're trying to do that. The problem with that are twofold. One is that it allows for mischievous enforcement actors like state AGs, but there are plenty of other people who would be delighted to be the bad guy in the story, to misclassify the content and say there's more adult-themed content that is not actually harmful in the way that we might be concerned about children being exposed to, quote, pornography, that then they can go and use the ambiguities of the definitions to regulate or target sites that actually were meant to be outside the scope of the law. The most obvious is sites that cater to things like LGBTQ communities, especially LGBTQ teens, where a number of enforcement actors are taking the position that is obscene as to minors. It is not by purposes of the definition, but who wants to go through the act of defending those laws and the costs and potential criminal exposure of doing so? It's an extremely dangerous scenario. But the more important piece is that this entire process of doing age authentication is a way to determine how to identify children to protect them. I just reject that construct entirely. A, because age authentication harms children and adults just by virtue of being done. But B, because it sidesteps the fact that there are a lot of other ways to think about how we can improve child safety, but more importantly, how we can benefit children to navigate the internet, to self-actualize. The idea here should not be let's bubble wrap children. The idea should be how can we build resilient children who are digitally literate, who can go off and use those skills to be their best selves as they become adults. And if we frame the question that way, this idea of segregating the internet into safe and not safe zones is weird. It's not necessarily unhelpful, but it's definitely not the primary way we would want to solve that problem. We would be thinking about how do we make kids more resilient? How do we teach them how to be savvy consumers of information? How do we teach them to use the tools for their best purpose? These are all things that we don't do while we're going around trying to segregate kids from adults using age authentication. So in my mind, I feel like the response to your question is to reframe the question. What goal are we trying to solve? If we're trying to help children be them best selves, then we're asking the wrong question by saying, what should we do about segregating porn from the internet?
So you said a lot there. You said a lot there. One of the things that you said is, and to bring the conversation back to specifically age verification and FSC v. Paxton, while the content conversation is interesting, content in the internet is potentially a future miniseries for the Foundry, if that's fair. While age assurance does gate content, that we're not going to pretend that these two things are inherently separate, we are going to bring the conversation specifically to age assurance. You said that age assurance specifically harms not just age assurance solutions, don't just harm the or limit the adult, but they also have harming effects on children. Could you explain, and while this is a mini series, we're going to speak with other guests about this as well, could you explain some of the harms that we could see or that are possible from age assurance on to children?
So we were talking earlier about these concerns about privacy and security, and those concerns are very much on my mind when it comes to children trying to navigate the internet, especially where there's some kind of age authentication process. If they are asked to do something like scan their faces so that automated systems can estimate their age, there's a bunch of implicit and possibly explicit harms in that process that are imposed on children. They are handing over valuable biometric information that they are hoping will not be stored, manipulated, and misused, but they have no way of validating or verifying that. And even if they did, as children, they may lack the cognitive tools and the skepticism necessary to properly vet that question and answer it for themselves before making the choice, should I show my face or not? So we're basically asking children who are presented with this dilemma, should I proceed or not, to make adult level decisions when the whole point is to protect them because we don't think they're capable of making adult level decisions. So that entire process is fraught with peril for the children. They don't know how to navigate it. They can't make good choices for themselves. And if they make the wrong choice, they expose themselves to enormous lifetime privacy and security risks that now they're much bigger problems than whatever they might have been bubble wrapped from accessing in terms of content.
The response to that would be, but the age assurance solutions, as stated in the opinion, that the age assurance solutions are supposed to be pointed at towards the adults using the platform to gate in order to say you are of age to access X. How do you respond to that?
So that's completely illogical. You cannot only age authenticate adults. The whole point of age authentication is because you don't know who are the adults and who are children. So you have to impose age authentication on the entire cohort of users and then identify that subset that are children and treat them specially. So children will be subject to age authentication if they try to access any site that is intended to be adults only. That's the whole point of doing age authentication in the first place. It's unavoidable.
A response to that is, what if I would prefer my child have these privacy losses and these privacy harms to the potential health and safety harms of seeing adult content before they are ready or of age?
So there's a couple of responses to that. One is that this is no longer an individual parent's choice. This is now a statewide mandate that applies across a lot of sites, even sites that the parents might not realize is going to be subject to that. So, if we think about this as a parental choice question, when the state mandates this across the entire internet community, then that choice has been remade for them. And this was squarely the discussion that was had in the Reno and Ashcroft opinions. The idea is that if you impose restrictions at the server level, those are actually negating parental choice in the first instance. And the second is that there may very well be parents who would say, I am more concerned about the risk of exposure of my children to pornography than I am about the privacy and security risks of face scanning. But that's a conversation that we need to have that way. We need to go ahead and tell the legislatures, you're going to harm some group of parents and children. Which are you picking? And that's not what the legislature did. They treated it as a categorical win across the entire segment of children. And that's clearly a lie.
Thank you for your answer. We've gotten a little off topic. And I still have two questions related to FSCB Thompson that I want to circle back to. Sorry for the I got dragged along with you. I was enjoying your answers.
Good.
What do you make of Justice Thomas's reasoning that Texas against Texas for not adopting rational basis, where he says, "quote, this position fails to account for the incidental burden of age verification necessarily has on an adult's First Amendment right to access speech that is obscene to minors." Is this an actual validation of something that exists, or is this something else?
This is Calvin Ball, and the opinion cannot possibly navigate that tension between, why are we concerned about the incidental burdens here, but we're not concerned about them when we have that later statement that adults have no right to receive content free of age authentication mandates. Like the Justice Thomas is talking out both sides of his mouth. I gave that statement little credit other than treating it as a Calvin Ball statement.
And so the dissent states, the other side of that, the dissent states, under ordinary First Amendment doctrine, the courts should subject HB 1181 to strict scrutiny because HB 1181 covers speech constitutionally protected for adults, impedes adults' ability to view that speech, and imposes that burden based on the speech's content. Can you differentiate these three parts?
You know, I didn't give a lot of credit to that either. I agree with the sentiment about that. And I think that we lose sight of exactly what we're talking about here. And so let me restate in my own term, and that might help inform the way that the dissent was thinking about it. But I'm not sure I could put any more logic to it. So we have consumers of content that are both children and adults. And so as consumers, we ask, what rights do they have as content consumers, or as, you know, watchers, viewers, readers of content? And then we have the publisher's interest. What rights do the publishers have to publish content? Again, publish to whom and in what venue, and what's the nature of the content? And the opinion, the majority opinion, flips back and forth between talking about it from the content consumer standpoint, talking about it from the publisher standpoint. The dissent's opinion, the language you just read, is principally focusing on the publisher's perspective. Now, there's a third category that gets lost in this equation, and I just want to surface it as well. There's content authors who are not the same as the publishers, or they're different category publishers. So the publishers who are represented in the opinion are people like Pornhub as an aggregator of content, maybe some that they own, much of which they acquire from third parties. But we should think in terms of not just the rights of the listener or content receiver, but the rights of the speaker as the individual who's trying to disseminate a message. And so when a minor is blocked from accessing a site, they are blocked not just as content consumers, but they are also blocked as content authors. Now, in the adult content industry, we might say that sounds pretty logical. Otherwise, they're creating child pornography, or CSAM is a more current term. But remember, these rules apply to sites that have one third or more of their content as restricted content. That could mean that there's a site that has two thirds of its content that is perfectly legitimate and available for both children and minors to both consume and author, that are still affected by this this law. And so the fact that we forget about the authoring rights that we have as users and how these laws restrict it is something I think gets lost in the equation of all this constitutional mumbo jumbo about what scrutiny level applies or how to treat it. There's so many interests here that are at play. And I think both opinions struggle to articulate all of them. There's just too much going on.
So as we come to the end here, it sounds like not only do you fundamentally disagree with the majority opinion, you fundamentally disagree with the dissent as well.
I don't fundamentally disagree with that. The dissent is right. This is a strict scrutiny scenario based on past precedent. And like, that's so obvious to me. I can't even believe that we're even having any of the discussion. That's the only non-Calvin Ball conclusion, in my opinion. Having said that, I don't think that the dissent went far enough, frankly. I think that there were so many rough edges in Justice Thomas's opinion, so many ways that he cut corners, played with the nomenclature, played with the doctrinal principles, so many that the dissent couldn't do them all. Like, it would just have been overwhelming to try and address them all. And as you know, they ran out of time, essentially. This was an opinion issued, the very last opinion on the very last day, the dissent didn't have all the time that they might have wanted to do a full deconstruction of every single problem in Justice Thomas's opinion. So it isn't that I disagree with the dissent. I think the dissent, if anything, wasn't strong enough, didn't go far enough, but there may not have been the time and luxury to do so.
All right. Thank you. I've appreciated your dissection of FSC v. Paxton, both the majority and the dissent. You addressed a lot of the issues of age assurance and a lot of the concerns of age assurance that I expect that will come up throughout the remainder of the miniseries. Do you have anything that we've left out that you would like to address on FSCV Paxton or age assurance?
Yeah, there's one more piece that we've hinted at, but I really want to hit the nail on the head here. Make sure that the listeners to this podcast haven't lost sight of this. So much of the discussion is framed as what's in the best interest of children. And I can't stress enough that that's not a fair question. It treats children as a monolithic community that has uniform interests. And the opinion talks about this just a little bit by suggesting that we might very well think of the concerns about the exposure of minor to sexually related content as different if they are prepubescent versus 17-year-olds 364 days old. That the needs of that audiences are just different. And when we talk about what's in their respective best interest, we're actually lumping them together as opposed to tearing those apart. And that's something that constitutional analysis usually accounts for and says, if your concern is to cover the best interests of children, but some children are going to be affected differently by the law, then we should look at that in the means fit analysis. But I'm so concerned that we lose sight of the fact that children's interests are often going to be oppositional to each other, that they're literally needing different things from the internet. And in those circumstances, there is no way to uniformly, without any suffering any harm, advance just the interests of all children. I think that once we recognize that the needs of children are very different, which we can kind of see when we're talking about adult material, but we can certainly see when we're talking about things like LGBTQ-related content or abortion-related content, that the needs of different groups of children might be in opposition to each other. Some children might need a lot of exposure to that content. Some children might want no exposure to that content. And so we cannot universally advance the interests of this category thing called children. All we can do is pick certain subcommunities of children and say, we are prioritizing the interests of those children and to the detriment of other children. And this is why I think that the child safety discussion has gotten so far off track. By trying to come up with ways of segregating adults from children and then thinking of children as a monolithic community that has uniform needs, we actually lose sight of the real goal, which is child safety. What do we need to do to keep children safe online? And if their interests are in opposition, they need different solutions to address their unique idiosyncratic needs. And so, this entire conversation, in my opinion, has gotten off track. And the majority opinion does a horrible job of addressing this issue. It doesn't even acknowledge the possibility. And by doing so, it essentially ignores the fact that everything that the majority does is going to harm children. And that itself is a damning indictment of any basis of saying that this law should survive intermediate scrutiny.
Professor Goldman, thank you so much on behalf of the ILPF Foundry. We've appreciated your time. Thank you for the past hour, I want to say. It's been, I hope that you've enjoyed the conversation and the ability to discuss this very interesting case. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity and thanks for guiding the conversation so well.